It's 11 a.m. Time to get started. Welcome back. You know, Shuli, a pleasure to have you. Part two, King Herod. King Herod, Yerushalayim. So we look forward to an audio-visual presentation. Bavakasha.
Okay. Yeah. Hi, everybody. So we are going to do part two of King Herod. If you weren't here last week, don't worry because it stands alone. And we're also going to do a very, very brief review. And if you were, you'll still be okay. Herod is such a seminal figure that he really does deserve two different sessions. So this is the second one. Last week we talked about Masada, we talked about Caesarea, we talked about how Herod came to power, his impact on the economy, right? Various issues of security and things like that. Today we are going to different sites. Okay? We're going to be going to Jerusalem because Jerusalem, the jewel in Herod's crown. We're going to be going to Herodian, as you can see in this amazing picture here. Herodian is one of my favorite sites, so I hope you guys like it as much as I do. And it's just so dramatic and beautiful, especially in the winter. We're going to take a quick look at Jericho, and a quick look at Hebron. But our main focus today is Jerusalem and is Herodian. And if we want to talk about the new issues, the other issues, what we're going to talk about today is who are Herod's allies? He has lots of enemies, but he actually does have allies as well, right? What is his connection to the rabbis, to religion, to Judaism? How do Jewish sources address Herod? What are his aesthetics, right? He has a very strong aesthetic sense. We already saw that last week in Masada and Caesarea. We're going to see it again. And what is his historic legacy, right? And we're going to also talk a little about his death and his grave because we are going to get to see it finally after it was searched for 40 years. Okay, so without further ado, let's get started. Just a very, very quick review. Okay, this is from last time. People remember. The olive green color is what Herod's kingdom is. Okay, by 37 BCE, when he first comes to power, and then he adds these extra areas on the coast in the Golan, right up here in the north, in the northeast, and Samaria, right, an area that was traditionally in Second Temple times at least very hostile to Jews. Samaritans and Jews did not get along, and yet he manages to rebuild the city of Samaria, calling it Sebaste, right, and to establish a center there as well. So he really moves beyond the core of the kingdom that the Hasmonean kings established of Judea and of the Galilee, and he moves into areas that are much less friendly to Jews, much more Hellenized or Samaritans, right, or even in the other side of the Jordan. So his political reach is very great, right? Again, very, very brief review timeline. Okay, we have 100 years of Hasmonean sovereignty, beginning with the story of Hanukkah, of course, right? Judah the Maccabee defeating the Greeks. The Hasmonean kings expand the area of the kingdom. And important to us in the story of Herod, Judah Maccabee's nephew, Yochanan Hyrcanus, right? Shimon Maccabee's son, he actually converts the Edomites living in the southern part of the land of Israel. And one of his converts is Herod's father, Antipater. So we talked about Herod's Judaism last time and his complicated relationship to his Judaism. After 100 years of Jewish sovereignty, the Romans step in ostensibly to end this civil war between two Hasmonean descendants, Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II, but basically to install themselves as rulers in the land of Israel. And they establish, we can call them puppet kings, but they actually have quite a lot of power. Okay, first Antipater, Herod's father, is appointed procurator. And then after a very brief resurgence of the Hasmonean kingdom, 3 years of Matityahu Antigonus, he's kicked out. Okay, Herod manages to get back in. And he rules from 37 before the Common Era to 4 before the Common Era when he dies and is buried in Herodian. Okay, so Herod comes to power partly because of the Roman need to have somebody reliable in the land of Israel as their representative, but partly because of his own skills in politics. Okay? He manages to navigate the very treacherous waters of Roman succession and Roman rivalry, right, with Antony and Cleopatra and Octavian and Julius Caesar. He manages to make the economy thrive and to build on an incredible scale. Okay, so that's just our little background to Herod. Where will we be traveling to today on this rainy evening in the land of Israel? Okay, so we are going to be starting out with Jerusalem. Like I said, you cannot talk about Herod without Jerusalem. And we talk about Jerusalem as one of the most significant time periods in its history is this last 100 years of Second Temple times. And that's because, well, not only, but largely because of Herod's building, rebuilding of the Second Temple and all the other buildings that he does. So we're going to start out in Jerusalem. Then we're going to go near Tekoa to Herodion, which is not here on this map, but right around here on the edge of the Judean desert. And like I said, we're going to take a quick look at Jericho. Okay. And then we're going to take a quick look down here at Hebron. But most of the time we are going to be, like we said, Jerusalem and Herodian. We're not going to go further down the desert. We're not going to go to the coast. These are the places that we're going to stick with. So let's get started with Jerusalem. Okay. Like I said, Jerusalem is really the jewel in Herod's crown. Now, he may not have identified so much with the values of Jerusalem, right? Caesarea might have been a much more comfy kind of place for him, but Jerusalem is the capital. Jerusalem is the place of the temple. Jerusalem becomes a huge tourism magnet. Think that's only today. It was then as well, right? Herod builds things that people want to come and see, right? So Jerusalem has to be very significant for Herod. And besides the rebuilding of the temple and the whole compound and everything around it, which is the centerpiece of the city, he also builds himself an incredible palace, as well as other structures in the city. And the infrastructure, let's not forget about the infrastructure. He needs to bring a lot of water to the city so that it can continue and can survive and thrive, because the natural water source, which you can actually get a sense of in this picture, I'll show you in a second, the Gihon Spring is not quite big enough. So what are we looking at here? We are looking at anyone who's been to Jerusalem, to the Israel Museum in the last 10 years, or maybe remembers it even earlier when it was in the Holy Land Hotel. This is a model of Second Temple Jerusalem, which used to be in a hotel on the edge of Bayit Vegan, which was knocked down and turned into this horrific apartment complex of towers on the edge of the city, the Holy Land complex. But the hotel used to have this model on its ground, and it's a model of Jerusalem at the end of Second Temple times, when Jerusalem is at its largest, the largest it's going to be until the late 19th century. And it's an amazing model for a few reasons, but I just want to show you one thing while we're just looking at what we have here. Okay. So we are looking at the city. We are in the south, right? We are in the south looking north here. Of course, I'm sorry, it's a little blurry. Here is the Temple Mount. Okay. And this long, narrow area here, this is the city of David, the beginnings of Jerusalem, and the Gihon Spring down at the bottom and the Shiloh Pool. Okay. So that's the water source, the original water source for the city, which is not enough. Okay. Now what's the story with this model? It's really an amazing story. The owner of the Holy Land Hotel in Bayit Vegan, a Jew named Hans Kroch. And I see people are putting questions in the chat. Don't forget, I will answer them at the end, I promise. Hans Kroch had a son named Zvi who fought in the War of Independence. And unfortunately, he was killed in the battle, like so many young men and women in 1948. Kroch wanted to do something to remember him, to memorialize him. So besides naming his hotel Eretz HaTzvi, right? Holy Land. What's Holy Land? Another name for the Holy Land is the Eretz HaTzvi. Tzvi was his son. He also decided that in memory of his son, he was going to create this attraction on the grounds of the hotel, this model of the city of Jerusalem. This is in the 1960s. Very nice, except here's the amazing thing. Half, or I would say even three quarters of what he did here was based only on literature, meaning we are in the mid 60s. The old city of Jerusalem is under the control of the Jordanians. Nothing has been excavated in the Jewish quarter. Very little has been excavated in the area of Jaffa Gate, a little bit more in the city of David, but so much of what needs to go into this model, we didn't know from archaeology at all. Now, the academic consultant was a professor named Michael Avionah, and mostly what he used uses is Josephus, the Mishnah, okay? And this is where we get to a fascinating question that we're going to come to in our last session when we talk about the Great Revolt. How reliable is Josephus, right? Yosef ben Matityahu, the historian of the Great Revolt. And we see that after the Six-Day War, when we started to excavate in these areas, we see that Josephus, when he doesn't have a good reason to lie, he usually tells the truth, right? Because so much of what was taken from literature, we have found in real life. Not everything, okay? Josephus talks about a hippodrome in Jerusalem, a place for horse races that hasn't been found yet. He talks about a theater that hasn't been found yet, but Herod's palace and the areas of the mansions in the upper city, and even this street, right? Take a look at this street. I'll show it to you better, okay? This street that goes from the Shiloach pool down at the bottom up towards the wall, the western wall, right? The whole western wall that surrounds the Temple Mount. This street is being uncovered piece by piece, right? The area by Robinson's Arch up here by the western wall, that was already uncovered in the 80s and the 90s. And this street over here is being uncovered today in the City of David in the last 10 years. And it's really unbelievable. We are finding all these things that we had previously known only from literature. So that's the Holy Land model, a short diversion, but important. Okay. And just to understand a little bit of what Herod's city looks like. Okay. So Jerusalem in Second Temple times starts out as a very narrow little city, meaning in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, right? Shivat Zion, the return to Zion. By the time we get to the story of Hanukkah, the Hasmoneans, the city has expanded what's called the first wall out towards Jaffa Gate and around and back. Okay, this is Hasmonean Jerusalem. Looks a lot like Jerusalem at the end of the first temple period. By the time we get to Herod, okay, the city has expanded again. And that's where we get the second wall, which we are not 100% sure of its exact borders, but it's been drawn like this for interesting reasons, mostly having to do with Christianity and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And this is Herod's Jerusalem, okay? This second wall, this is Herod's Jerusalem, okay? Bigger than it was in the time of the Hasmoneans, but not at its greatest growth, which is at the very end of Second Temple times, the last 50, 70 years, where we have what's called the third wall, which actually extends beyond today's old city walls, right? That's over here. Extends all the way to the Russian compound near Mea Shearim, right? Outside of Damascus Gate. And the city is much larger. Herod has his palace over here by Jaffa Gate, okay, in the upper city, where he can look down on the Temple Mount and everything that he's created and all the things that he's done. He has towers to fortify the city. We'll come back to that and we'll talk about that, why he builds this palace over here on the west, where are the towers, how is he protecting the city, as well as all these aqueducts bringing water into the city. Okay, so it's just to give us a little bit of an idea of what does Herod's Jerusalem actually look like. Now, obviously, the main project or the project that's most important to the rabbis and most important to Jews today is the temple, right? Now, the temple is not built by Herod, right? The temple is the second temple, rebuilt by the returnees, right? The return to Zion, come back less than 70 years after the first temple is destroyed. They lay the foundations and they build a relatively small temple, which grows with the Hasmoneans and which grows again with Herod. What Herod does, and we can call it Temple 3.0, right, is he rebuilds, he expands the walls around. We're going to look at the platform in a minute. He expands the walls around the Temple Mount so that you have greater surface area up here, and he rebuilds. Okay, and we hear about this in Josephus. We hear about this in the Talmudic sources, that the people are suspicious. Is it, what's he going to do? Maybe he's not going to put it back up. And he promises that there will not be one day where there won't be sacrifices. He'll take things apart. He'll rebuild at the same time. And in the end, he creates this incredible building. Now, the rabbis have a very ambivalent attitude towards this building. On the one hand, we have this famous statement, right? The temple, if you have not seen Herod's building, you have never seen a beautiful building in your life, right? Bava Batra, the beginning of Bava Batra. But Herod is not exactly a hero in rabbinic literature, and that's where we get this fascinating story. Okay, people who were here last week, we looked a little bit at this Gemara, but we didn't go into the story. Okay, and here's the story, which on the one hand talks about Herod's corruption and his antagonism to the rabbis, but on the other hand, what he does to make up for it in a sense, right? So here's the Gemara. Who are they, he said, this is Herod speaking, who teach from the midst of your brothers, you shall set up a king over you, stressing the word brothers, achecha, the rabbis, right? Now Herod, certainly according to the rabbis, knows that he is not a Jew and he is a slave according to the rabbis, and therefore he is not a legitimate king. So what does he do? If you don't like what somebody says, he therefore arose and killed all the rabbis, sparing, however, Baba ben Buta. Now Baba ben Buta is a Tana who shows up very little, but here and there in the Gemara, we do hear about him in other places. And according to this Gemara, he is the only rabbi who is spared. It's clear he's not the only rabbi who's spared. We do hear about other rabbis, but there definitely is a purge. We're going to talk about this at the end. There is a purge of the rabbinic leadership by Herod. Whether he kills them all or they have to go underground, they're definitely in danger. But in this Gemara, we have a little hyperbole. Only Baba ben Buta is left. He placed on his head a garland of hedgehog bristles and he put out his eyes, right? He blinded him. One day he came and sat before him and said, "See, sir, what this wicked slave Herod does." So Herod takes advantage of Baba ben Buta's blindness and he comes and pretends that he is someone else. And he says, "Look at this terrible man, this terrible slave. What do you want me to do to him?" replied Baba ben Buta. He said, "I want you to curse him." He replied with the verse, "Even in thy thoughts, you should not curse the king," said Herod to him, "but this is no king." He replied, "Even if he is only a rich man, and in thy bedchamber, do not curse the rich. Be he no more than a prince, it is written, a prince among thy people, you shall not curse." This, said Herod to him, "this applies only to one who acts as one of thy people, but this man does not act as one of thy people." So Herod keeps prodding him, right? Are you going to say something bad? And say something bad about him? And he can't get him to do it, okay? Finally, Baba ben Buta says, "I am afraid of him." "But," said Herod, "there's no one who can go and tell him, since we two are quite alone." He replied, "For a bird of the heaven shall carry the voice, and that which has wings shall tell the matter." Baba ben Buta will not say anything bad about Herod. Herod then said, "I am Herod. Had I known the rabbis were so circumspect, I should not have killed them." Ah, Herod has this moment of enlightenment. "I really should have spared those rabbis." And he says to Baba ben Buta, "Now tell me what amends I can make." He replied, "As you have extinguish the light of the world, for so the rabbis are called, for the commandment is a light and the Torah a lamp, go and attend to the light of the world, which is the temple of which it is written, and all the nations become enlightened by it." Okay, the Gemara is doing something fascinating here. Okay, it is taking something that is clearly a good thing, right? It's a good thing that the temple is rebuilt. It's big, it's splendid. So many people can come to it. It has all this glory, but yet it's built by this terrible person, by Herod. How can those two things go together? So what the Gemara does is takes Herod's motivation, which is probably to show off and to make something fabulous, and he turns it into tshuva, right? Into an attempt to atone for his actions. And this way, we legitimize Herod's building of the temple. All right? I'll just give you a different explanation, which I thought was amazing, right? By Rav Meidan, right? Rav Yaakov Meidan here in Yeshivat Haaretzion. And he says, how can we consider Herod's temple legitimate, right? You have King David that God says to him in the book of Chronicles, you can't build the temple because you have blood on your hands. And here's this person who, his hands are filled with blood, right? Yadecha damim aleihu. His hands are as bloody as they come. How can his temple be legitimate? And Rav Meidan says, don't look at Herod as a very bad Jew. Look at him as a very good non-Jew. Right? It's a fascinating way to look at it. If you think of Herod not as Jewish, right, and kind of as an extension of Cyrus, who starts the building of the second temple, then what he does is, this is a good thing that he's doing for the Jews in the, you know, mosaic of all the bad things that he's doing. Very interesting approach. Okay. But in any case, Herod rebuilds. And what does he do? In order to have more space, okay, he has to build on Mount Moriah. He has to build on the Temple Mount. Temple Mount is a mountain. It's not particularly big. Okay. At a certain point already in the Hasmonean period, the walls around the mountain are built and are expanded. Herod adds to them, and this is still something that we're questioning, by the way, right? He adds this whole southern area so that he can build this whole new structure, the royal stoa over here, right? The Mishnah in Megillah talks about 500 amot by 500 amot. That's the sacred precinct, meaning that's the original area where the actual building and the courtyards are. But Herod adds to all these places. Now, this is something that's still being asked, still being questioned. We're still excavating. In fact, a few years ago, there was a whole storm because this area in the corner, the southwest corner by Robinson's Arch that we're going to talk about in a minute, they excavated down to the foundations and actually found coins that post-date Herod. So does that mean that Herod didn't build this part of the wall? Does it mean that when they renovated the street here, those coins fell in? The jury is still out. So we will not be answering that question today, but it is an interesting question. But take a look at one more thing that Herod adds, right, on the northern edge of the Temple Mount, not on the Temple Mount itself, but abutting it, he builds this large structure called the Antonia Fortress. Okay, Antonia, named after Mark Anthony, he always has to name after people who are his patrons. Okay, and he builds this fortress. Why? As a protection for the temple. The most vulnerable direction in Jerusalem is the north. There are no deep valleys in the north to protect from an invading army. And so you need to have a strong fortress here at the northern point. The irony, of course, is that when the Roman generals, when Vespasian and then Titus break into the city, Titus uses the Antonia as his headquarters from which to storm the Temple Mount. So the plan backfires. But that's the idea of building this fortress at the northern edge of the Temple Mount. Okay, I had to add this picture just because it's a great picture. We're going to talk about this wall, right? And the street along the wall. So before we get to the picture, let's just place ourselves, those of us who have been to Jerusalem, and I assume that as many of us here, right, will have a little bit of an understanding where we are when we're looking at this picture here on the right. Okay, if we were to keep on walking along the street and pretend this wall at the end doesn't exist, you would get to the Kotel, to the Western Wall, right? The Western Wall is a very long wall. Okay, it's about a half a kilometer long. Okay, we only pray at one small part of it, but it's actually, we have the entire wall is basically intact. Some of it is underground, and that's if you ever gone into the Western Wall tunnels, you've gone in the continuation of the wall. And this southern section, okay, was excavated in the excavations that were done after the Six-Day War. And we discovered the street from Second Temple times, the stores, the remains of Robinson's Arch after it fell down, really incredible things. So what's the picture of the cute little boy on the left? The cute little boy on the left is my brother when he was 13. He is now closing in on 40. And so this is a picture taken in the early 90s. And people who recognize this corner with the hole, okay, today, that corner with the hole is right about here, okay? So in the early 90s, this was street level, and everything that you see in the picture on the right was yet to be excavated, okay? So that's always, it's always very eye-opening to look at these things and to say, oh, they weren't always here. I mean, they were always here. They weren't always exposed. We didn't always know what they looked like. And here you can really see from not very long ago how this area was not exposed at all, and we have taken it apart and found out so much. So what's this street? Okay, people like to call it Wall Street. It's the street along the wall, right? And it begins all the way in the south by the Shiloh Pool, down by the City of David. That's where you would start your journey as an Ole Regel, as a pilgrim. You'd get some water, you'd hear some news, you'd find out what's going on. And then you start heading up this main street, which, like I said, is being exposed today by the City of David, by the excavators there. And eventually you would come to this area below the Temple Mount, right? You still have to go up to the Temple Mount. We're not there yet. But below the Temple Mount, where you would have a whole commercial area. These are stores over here. And this is where you buy your animals for sacrifices. This is where you do all sorts of other, whatever purchases you have to make. There are also mikvaot, ritual baths near here. This is what you do to prepare in order to go up. And once you are done, you can ascend by this amazing pedestrian bridge that is called Robinson's Arch. There were no Kohanim named Robinson. Robinson was Edward Robinson, who was an American Bible scholar and archaeologist. He was one of the first archaeologists to come to the land of Israel and to really do serious scientific work already in the early part of the 19th century, 1840s. And he noticed, he was the first person really to notice this strange protrusion in the wall. So why is this thing sticking out here? And I remember street level at that time was about here, but he still noticed there was something strange sticking out of the wall. And he posited that this was part of a large arch. Now he thought it was an arch that was part of a bridge that went all the way across to the Western Hill, to the Jewish quarter of today. We now know it was part of an arch here of this pedestrian bridge that rested upon the stores on the other side. And when you finished everything you had to do, this was one way that you could ascend and go up into the Temple Mount. When the Romans destroy the temple and destroy Jerusalem, they pull out the keystone, right? An arch is an amazing engineering feat. But if you take out the middle stone that holds it all together, then the whole thing comes crashing down. And we can see the hole. That's what you saw in the picture. Sorry. Let's just go back there for a second. No. Sorry. Okay, that's what you see over here in this indentation in the ground. That's from where Robinson's arch fell down. Okay, so we can see here what it must have looked like in the time that the temple was standing, really something very, very impressive. Let's talk a little bit about how this was all built. Okay, oh, the Antonia Fortress we mentioned already to protect the city. None of it is standing anymore. When the Romans destroy the temple, destroy the city, they destroy the fortress as well. And instead, they create a street here, a forum. Okay? And that's a story for a different time. Where does the stone come from for all these massive building projects that Herod is doing? So we have a few quarries. Okay, the most famous quarry is right by the Damascus Gate. It's called Ma'arat Tzidkiyahu, Zedekiah's Cave. Zedekiah, last king of Judah in the First Temple times. There's legends about how he escaped the city through an underground cavern. It is not this cave, because this cave doesn't go anywhere, right? It starts out at Damascus Gate and it goes deeper under the city. But it's a cave that's already known about in the times of the Gemara. The Gemara talks about this massive cave. It's not a natural cave, or more accurately, the beginning of it is a natural cave. And then Herod and others use it as a huge quarry and just dig deeper and deeper and deeper. And the picture you can see here on the left, you can see very clearly that it's a quarry, right? You can see the indentations on the wall where they would cut out these massive blocks of stone. Hey, this is actually a picture from the late 19th or the early 20th century. The Freemasons, right? They thought this was King Solomon's cave, and King Solomon is their patron saint, their big builder, and they would hold their meetings here. So that's a great story in and of itself. Okay. The stone is brought from here. It's brought from other quarries to the north of the city. Okay. Area called Shuafat, Ramat Shlomo of today, and is dragged and schlepped to the Temple Mount and to the other building projects Herod does in Jerusalem. Herod, of course, is famous for his very exacting and beautiful stonework, right? These nice frames around the stones. This is a picture from the master course, what's called the master course in the Western Wall tunnels, where you can see these stones that are weighing over 400, 500, 600 tons, right? Incredible, incredible, huge things, which we still don't really fully know how they were able to move such things, but they provided a strong foundation for the buildings that are going to be on top of the Temple Mount. Now, Herod has all these stonemasons come and learn their craft. And stonemasonry becomes a very Jewish craft. And it's interesting. And there's a lot of work that has to be done on the temple. And you can imagine that all sorts of young men are, you know, coming from the countryside. There are good jobs to be had in Jerusalem. Herod's paying nicely. He's training you to have a new profession. They come, they learn how to be stonemasons. And then after a couple of years, more like 8 years, the temple is finished. What are you going to do? You're not going back home to the farm, right? So what you do is you take your new skills And there's an explosion of stonework in Jerusalem. And that's where we get a few very interesting things, right? A lot of people know that Second Temple times, the dishes, certainly of the wealthier people, but not only, were often not pottery, right? Clay, which is the easiest and the cheapest thing to make, but they were stone, right? And these are vessels from the Herodian Quarter in Jerusalem, right? Houses of the Kohanim from around this time with these very beautiful stone vessels. Why would you make something from stone? It's very hard, it's very expensive, but there's a reason for it, an internal reason, right? We're going to talk about the external reason, but the internal reason is that according to Jewish law, stone vessels do not become impure, right? What that means is if you are in the kitchen with grandma and grandma drops dead, your clay vessels now have to all be gotten rid of. They have become tamei. You cannot use them anymore. Stone vessels, you're in great shape. Nothing happens to them. They cannot be harmed in any way. So that's the internal reason. Second Temple times, everybody is very, very, very concerned with purity. And so they want to have things that will stay pure. But the external reason is we've got a lot of stone workers who need jobs. And so we have a glut of stone work, stone vessels, stone ossuaries, right? Bone boxes with beautiful, beautiful carvings on them. I brought you one here that is not beautiful, but it's fascinating because if you look at it, you can see that it has an inscription both on the side and on the front. It's the same inscription. And it's pretty easy to read. It's actually the same letters as we use. Simon Bone Hechala. This guy was buried in this ossuary, right? His bones only, the secondary burial. What did he want written there? The one thing he wants written is his name and that he took part in building the temple. That's his claim to fame. Simon, the builder of the temple. And it shows you it's something that was a source of great pride for people, whether or not they liked Herod. But building the temple was really something that was a source of national pride. Now, Herod doesn't just build the temple. Of course, he built himself a palace because he's got to build palaces everywhere. And of course, he's going to build himself a palace in Jerusalem, in the capital. Like I said, a lot of what we knew about this palace, we knew about from Josephus, right? Josephus writes about the palace and the towers and the pools and all its fabulousness, okay? A lot of which is being excavated today, right? In the last 20, 30 years by the Tower of David, because this is where it is. It's in the Tower of David, right by Jaffa Gate. So a lot of what we kind of conjectured in the model based on Josephus, we are now seeing in real life. And what you're seeing in the picture here on the right, this is from a video that the Tower of David did to kind of imagine what Herod's palace looked like, because we found these steps leading down to a pool. We found the foundations of the palace. It was a massive thing that went all the way from Jaffa Gate all the way down towards Zion Gate, right? He has ornamental pools. What's going on? Jerusalem doesn't have a lot of water. Well, if you're Herod, you want to show off that you can have as much water in your palaces as you want. So you have these ornamental palaces. He also has an amazing location, right? Jaffa Gate, if you've ever walked from Jaffa Gate down to the Western Wall, down to the Western Wall, Jaffa Gate is higher, okay? So he's able to look out on the Temple Mount, look out at what he created. Today, what's left of all this, okay? So what's left of all this, Josephus tells us he builds three guard towers, okay? The West is also something of a vulnerable spot. So his palace, like so many of his palaces, is not just a palace, it's also a fortress. And he builds three guard towers. One of them, the Fatzael Tower, is still existing today. And that's the picture you see here on the right. And you can go up on the top and you have one of the nicest views in Jerusalem, okay? And that was known already for a while. But what was discovered much more recently is the picture on the left. And these are excavations right next door to the Tower of David Museum. This is in a place called the Kishle. Kishle means barracks. It was Turkish barracks. Then it was a British prison, okay, with a lot of famous people like Zev Jabotinsky who were there. But in the early 90s, the Tower of David decided they were going to do an excavation here, and they uncovered below the prison, right, layers that went back. Well, they went all the way back to First Temple times and the wall of the city from there, but they also go down to the foundations of Herod's palace. So it's really, we're really starting to find the pieces of the puzzle that we had only known about from literature. Okay, a couple more things about Jerusalem, and then we are going to move on. We need water, right? We said there's not enough water. What are you going to do? How are you going to bring all this water? So Herod cannot rely only on the water in the city. So what he does, the Hasmoneans start it, the Romans continue it, but Herod is a large part of this story. He creates these incredible aqueducts, okay? The upper one and the lower one, bringing water from the south, from the area of Gush Etzion, from near me, okay, where there are a lot of springs, and he brings them in these two aqueducts, which are incredible because they traverse many kilometers and they have to deal with the problems of topography, right? It's not like Gush Etzion is high up and everything, and it's all the way downhill to Jerusalem. It is, meaning he has to figure out how to do that, and it's a tiny, tiny gradient. And he does that by having his engineers build tunnels, build bridges, build all kinds of things in order to bring the water safely all the way to Jerusalem in two aqueducts. And there it's put into various pools and brought to the Temple Mount as well as to the upper city. Now, along the way, about halfway along the way, there's this junction called Brichot Shlomo, Solomon's Pools. Again, nothing to do with Solomon. He is not part of the story, but just like King David, anything big and impressive gets named after people from First Temple times. Now, these pools are kind of like, a reservoir. It's a halfway point to gather the water and then to send it back out again. These pools still exist today. Okay. Today they are on the outskirts of Beit Lechem, of Bethlehem, on the edge of the northernmost neighborhood of Ephrat. Unfortunately, they are not always accessible to the Israeli public. They're not really in Bethlehem, but they're not really in Israel either. And occasionally the army will escort you. I actually got to see it for the first time last year. And you can go see what's left. And they really are incredible, massive pools. This picture on the left here is from over 100 years ago, where you can see these three pools very clearly. Today, you don't see them as clearly. You see the bottom and the middle one very nicely, but they really were amazing, amazing things that helped with bringing the water to Jerusalem. Okay, one more thing about water. If you've ever gone to the Western Wall tunnels to the tour, you know that at the very end, you come out by this pool, right? And this is called the Struthian Pool. And it's one of this network of pools that Herod builds. It's actually rather small. It's one of the small ones. Struthian means, in Greek, means a little bird. It's a little pool, but important because it's right up next to the Temple Mount, and you needed a lot of water for the Temple Mount. And today, when you come out of the Western Wall tunnels, you'll see half of the pool. You only see half of it, and there's a wall that is separating you from the other half. If you want to see the other half, you have to go up the stairs, out to the street, cross the street, go into a building that belongs to the convent of the Daughters of Zion, okay? Go down the stairs again, and you will see the other half of the pool. Why is the pool cut in half? Because when all of this was still very unknown, another one of these amazing explorers, this one, an English one named Charles Warren, came and started to explore what we know today are the Western Wall tunnels. And at a certain point, he hit some water, and he found some old boards, and he used them as rafts, and he sailed along until he got to a point where he saw there was an exit, and he managed to get out, and he walked straight out into the convent, and the nuns were none too pleased, and they did not like this at all, and so they put a wall between the two, between their part of the pool and the rest of the pool, but you can see the whole thing today in two different pieces. Okay, before we get to Jericho, you have this nice picture to look at. Let's talk for a minute about Herod's allies, okay? Who is on his side? We make it sound like everybody's his enemy, but it's not true, okay? He gets rid of the old elite. He doesn't like the rabbis. He doesn't like the Hasmoneans, okay? He has a few Hasmonean ties. He marries a Hasmonean princess, but then he kills her. Not so good for the ties, okay? Kills his brother-in-law. But he does make other strong ties, firstly, and perhaps most importantly, with Rome. He makes the land of Israel part of the Pax Romana, right? Part of this peace that Rome creates all over the world. We might not like the Romans, but they kept the peace, and they kept the road safe, and they kept the economy stable. And Herod makes the land of Israel part of that, and holds off any kind of rebellion at least throughout his time period and for decades afterwards. Okay. He also has people who are beholden to him. Okay. The Edomites, his family, right? Hellenists, as opposed to the rabbis, and Jews from outside of the land of Israel, right? There's a dynasty called the Tabaids from Transjordan. You have Egyptian Jews, you have Babylonian Jews. They are less disturbed than the land of Israel Jews by the idea of working with a foreign power. Okay. Interesting. We'll come back to that at the end. So he has these new allies. Now, how does he get people to like him? He has these amazing building projects, some of which he names after, you know, his patrons. He builds everything in Jerusalem so the Jews will like him. He's not particularly interested in the temple. He uses the anger. We know there's a lot of anger, a lot of backlash at the Hasmoneans. He uses that in his favor. What if people don't like him? Well, he's a little bit got a quick on the trigger finger. Right? He kills wives. He kills sons. He kills rivals. He kills in-laws. You don't like him? Not so good for you. Right? So he uses the carrot and the stick in order to build himself very strong alliances. And the fact is that even though he is sure that he is going to be assassinated, he lives out his life. He dies of illness and old age. He does not get assassinated by anybody. All right, let's talk about Jericho for a second. Jericho is much less well known than the other building projects that Herod made, mostly because A, not so much of it is left, and B, a lot of it is off limits in the Palestinian Authority today. But Jericho, very important city because it's very fertile, it's warm, it's a great winter retreat for the people of Jerusalem. Already the Hasmoneans start out and build palaces there, and Herod adds to that. He builds three palaces and he creates this amazing complex over the riverbed of Wadi Kelt, right, where he has palaces on both sides and a bridge and pools and sunken gardens. Very little, if you're getting like planning to make a trip, very little is left, unfortunately. We have a little bit of what's left of the swimming pool, where, by the way, he drowns his brother-in-law, who's the high priest and is too popular for him, so not so good for him. Okay, we also have this beautiful technology, which is called opus reticulatum. It's an Italian technology where it's beautiful, but it's also strong. You create a front, a facade out of these beautiful stones, and then you fill it with concrete. And this is one of the places where we really see it. And Jericho becomes this kind of winter playground for Herod and for other people as well. He builds a theater there, he builds a hippodrome, and people come from Jerusalem to Jericho. Jericho, of course, is known as Ir HaTamarim, okay, the city of the dates. If you're learning Daf Yomi, tomorrow you will hear all about the date farmers in Jericho. But that's because it's got a lot of water. It's got a very, very warm climate, so you can grow all year round. So Jericho's known as the city of the dates, but it's also the city of balsam, of Afar Simon. Okay, people who live in Israel may know Afar Simon is the name for a persimmon, but we are not talking about persimmons. Afar Simon was a plant that was used to make a very powerful, very desirable perfume. Okay? We hear about it in the Gemara. We hear about it in Josephus. And Herod has Afar Simon balsam plant by Jericho. Okay, the picture that you're seeing here, there's a scientist in Bar-Ilan University named Professor Zohar Amar who tries to regrow all of these ancient varieties. And he's attempting to, he has succeeded in growing balsam. Now he's trying to make the perfume, which we don't really know how it smelled. So that's a little tricky, but kind of neat. Okay, let's go to Herodian. Now, we mentioned this last time, and this is a picture on the left here of Herod's northern palace in Masada. Herod has an amazing sense of aesthetics. Everything he makes is very beautiful. And I said this last time, right? You can have people with a lot of money who have very bad taste. Herod has very good taste. Right? Take a look at how he builds the palace into the side of the cliff in Masada, how he builds Herodian. It's amazing, right? This palace on top of the mountain, growing out of the mountain. He makes sure to place his tomb halfway along the mountain where everybody can see it. A few years ago, there was an exhibit in the Israel Museum about Herod's buildings. And one of my favorite, very, very small items, but it was so great. They had something from the palaces in Jericho. It seems that the workers who worked on the palace, who did the painting, were kind of careless. Not sure what happened to them, but they left their paint pots behind. Okay. And you could see the colors, which were so vivid and vibrant, purples and yellows and reds, incredibly beautiful things. Now, Ehud Netzer, we're going to talk about in a second, archaeologist who his whole career was connected to Herod. He did many things, but he was always going back to Herod. And he started his career as an architect. Now, he was an architecture student. He worked in Masada as an architect, and then he got bitten by the archaeology bug. So he knows about aesthetics and architecture. And this is what Ehud Netzer said about Herod. I encountered so many unique architectural designs and solutions that I gradually came to the conclusion that there was one mind behind them all, that Herod had a profound understanding of architecture and urban planning and took an active note in the erection of his many buildings. It wasn't just that he hired good people. He himself had a very strong aesthetic sense. So we're going to take a look at Herodion, which has had a distinctive shape and has been intriguing to people for a very long time. It was known long before excavation started. This is a picture from the 19th century where you can see Herodion sticking up there in the background. Anyone who's driven in southern Jerusalem, you've seen Herodion. It looks almost a little bit like a volcano, right? It's this really strange looking structure. And that's because Herod builds his palace into the mountain in really an amazing way. So where is Herodion? Okay, Herodion is here on the edge of the Judean desert, okay? Between the mountains of Jerusalem, of Gush Etzion, and the desert, okay? And when you go up on top of Herodion, certainly on a winter day, it's really incredible because on one side of the mountain, you have the green and the hills of Jerusalem and Ramat Rachel and Beit Lechem. And on the other side, you have the desert and you can see all the way to the Dead Sea. And if it's a really good winter day, you can sometimes even see it raining in Jerusalem and sunny by the Dead Sea. So it's on the edge of the desert, what we call Sfar HaMidbar, right? The frontier. It's there for security reasons, okay? Because we need to protect against the bandits that are gonna come into the civilized land. But I think Herod also chose it because it was beautiful. It really is just such an incredibly impressive and beautiful place. Now here's Ehud Netzer, who we mentioned before. Ehud Netzer starts out as an architect in Masada, and his whole career is connected to Herod. He does a doctorate in archaeology on Jericho, on the palaces in Jericho and in Herodion. He dug in Herodion from the beginning of the excavations until his death, right, in 2010, and he poetically, if tragically, died at Herodion. He was there working, and he leaned on a guardrail that wasn't steady and he fell and he suffered injuries that led to his death a few days later. But he worked up to the very end, and his goal in Herodion obviously was to uncover everything that Herod made, but he was also always looking for the tomb, because Josephus tells us that Herod died in Jericho, but he was buried in Herodion. That's where he prepared his tomb. And Ehud Netzer, in everything that he dug out, was always looking for the tomb. He dug the lower city, he dug the upper city, in the palace, and he was always looking for the tomb, which was finally discovered, and we'll see it in a few minutes, in 2007. Okay, so he is very, very connected to the site. This is a picture of Herodion with the lower city. Okay, Herodion is not just a fortress, it's not just a palace, it was an administrative center for the whole area of the Judean desert around it, collecting taxes and a military garrison, and you need to have a place for all those people to live. So he built this lower city, which had all the amenities that Herod could provide, a nice bathhouse, a swimming pool, right? It's not as well excavated as the upper city, but it still is important. And it has its own water supply, because here we are in the desert, so there's an aqueduct bringing water to here also. But really the super impressive part of Herodion is the palace on the top. What does Herod do? Okay, he takes this mountain, which its bottom is basically the courtyard here, and he builds around the mountain 8-story high round wall. Okay, actually a double wall. And you can see that here, right? Here's the inner wall and here's the outer wall, okay, with space in between for the servants to live. Okay. In each of the corners of the compass, he puts a half tower, and on the eastern side, he puts a full tower. And you can imagine, here you are riding along on your donkey in the desert, and suddenly you see a mountain that has 8 stories rising out of it. You've never seen a building that's taller than one story in your life. This is amazing. Okay, now to add to the effect, Herod actually takes dirt and covers up the first few stories of the wall so that it really looks as though the palace is rising from the mountain itself. And it's an actual skyscraper. It's an incredibly tall building. He has public areas in the middle. He probably lived in this eastern tower. He adds all kinds of Roman amenities, right? A bathhouse. You have to have a bathhouse. The hot room, which is, you can see the remains of the furnace here. Most of it was taken away and is in the Israel Museum. You have this beautiful little middle room, right? Every bathhouse has to have a hot room, a cold room, and a just right room, a tepidarium, with this incredible round ceiling, right? With an area, a hole on the top so that the steam can escape. And it's aesthetically just amazing. And again, it shows us Herod's connection to Roman culture, because what's a Roman palace without a bathhouse? You need to have a water supply. So he creates this aqueduct, bringing water, again, from the area of Gush Etzion, bringing it in an aqueduct to massive cisterns that are cut into the mountain. Okay, carried up from the pools from the bottom, carried up by slaves into these massive cisterns that we're going to come back to in a minute, but with access from the courtyard, right? There's a hole in the middle of the courtyard so that the servants could get water directly to bring it to the bathhouse. Okay, not only does he have a bathhouse and a courtyard and a dining room, he creates a home theater, right? You think home theaters are just for today? Herod has them as well. Now, this theater was just discovered relatively recently, and it's part of the whole story of discovering the tomb, okay? This theater was discovered, and it was in perfect, pristine condition. You can see the stage that's left here. You can see the stands, the seats, right, in the half circle here. It's in perfect condition. Why was it in perfect condition? Because when Herod is preparing for his death, he doesn't want the theater to take away from the view of the tomb. So he tells his architects, cover up the theater, bury it, put it into Gniza. So it stays in perfect condition. Besides the structure itself, there are also these incredibly rare and beautiful wall paintings on the walls, which today are being restored, and you can go see them. Actually, they're going to be put back in Herodian, right? And here he covers it all up so that he can create this tomb, which Ahudnezzar finally discovers in 2007. Not much left of it. Remains of a large podium, okay? Plus remains of other small pieces that make us think that this is what it looked like, right? This is based on what was left, as well as similar monuments in the Kidron Valley and in Petra, right, from the same time period. Why do we not have it anymore? And how do we know that it's Herod's? Well, we know that it's Herod's because it's the only really impressive object like that that could be a grave, and nobody else would be buried there except for Herod. By the tomb, they found many, many pieces of this beautiful, beautiful pink marble with an elaborate rosette on it, and they were able to reconstruct it to create this sarcophagus, right? So Herod would be the only person who would be worthy of something so incredibly fancy. Why is it destroyed? Oh, well, the reason it's destroyed is because the next occupants of Herodian are the Jewish zealots, the rebels against Rome, and they see Herod as the complete enemy. He allies himself with Rome. He is somebody who is giving in to the Romans. He doesn't understand that you have to fight against them. And so they destroy his tomb completely, but they still left the pieces behind for us to discover. And here are the zealots. They arrive. They do some changes in Herod's palace. They add mikvaot, right next to the room that was Herod's dining room, which they turned into a synagogue, one of the oldest synagogues in the land of Israel, same time period as the synagogue in Masada. And they use Herodian as a fortress when they fight against the Romans. They are unsuccessful, but that's not the end of the story. In Masada, that's the end of the story. But in Herodian, there's yet another incarnation 65 years later, another group of rebels come, and that's the rebels of Bar Kokhba. And they were a complete surprise to the excavators. When they were excavating, they discovered that those massive water cisterns, remember this water cisterns we saw here, right? These cisterns, they were filled to the top with dirt, not a natural filling, not an erosion. It wouldn't be possible. They were literally filled up to the top. And what the archaeologists discovered soon afterwards is that there was a whole network of tunnels carved into the mountain. Okay? Bar Kokhba, we know, used guerrilla tactics. He had to go underground to fight the Romans because there were many more Romans than there were Judean rebels. And he carves out these tunnels in the mountain. And in order for the Romans not to know what he has done, he takes that dirt and he puts it into the cistern. What does he do for water? That's a very good question, which we have not solved yet. But these tunnels are in pristine condition. We know they are from the time of Bar Kokhba because the only artifacts that were found in there were oil lamps that are from the time of Bar Kokhba. And were they used in a surprise attack on the Romans? We don't know. But we do know that Bar Kokhba had a headquarters at Herodion. We hear about it in the Bar Kokhba letters that were discovered about 50 years ago. So Herodion, really something that shows Herod's aesthetic sense, shows his overcoming nature, and also shows, like we saw in Masada, that he couldn't control what was happening after his death, and it ended up being used by people who he probably wouldn't have been so supportive of. And that's the way it goes. Even Herod could not control things after his death. Okay, the last site we're going to look at before we kind of wrap up Herod's legacy is Hebron. Okay, now when you go to Hebron and you see this building that is of Marat HaMachpelah, which is a very, very famous site, right? You have to go inside to get to the rooms that are the graves of the Avot and the Imahot, but the building, it does not take an archaeology student to realize that these walls look just like the walls around the Temple Mount. Okay, it's the same design, it's the same kind of carving. And it's an interesting puzzle because Josephus doesn't write about Herod building the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, but it clearly is Herodian. What's his connection to the site? We know the Edomites moved into Hebron at a certain point. Maybe he's building it here. Maybe it's another way to curry favor with the Jews. We don't know. But the building itself is clearly a Herodian building. And we just don't have any literary record of it yet. Who knows? Okay, so let's understand a little bit about Herod. We'll come back to this question in a moment, which I think is an important question. Let's make a balance sheet, right? On the pro side, Herod is amazing for the economy. Right, he brings in tons of money. As I said last time, he's one of the few kings in history who dies leaving more money in the treasury than when he came in. And that's despite all his incredible building projects. Okay, he leaves behind a legacy of construction, of urban planning, of building that is second to none. Nobody builds like Herod before or after him. And perhaps the most significant one, political stability. He holds off war with Rome for 100 years, right? Whether he himself or the legacy that he leaves after him, we have 100 more years of peace. People will argue that maybe that wasn't such a good thing, but the Great Revolt does not end well, and Herod holds it off. So those are the pros. What are the cons? A lot of murders, okay? And particularly, very significant for us, he murders a lot of the rabbis, and he undermines them, and a generation goes underground. And a great example of this, a tragic example of this, we have mentions in the Gemara, famous story of Korban Pesach, right? Hillel has to come from Babylonia in order to determine the halacha concerning something about Korban Pesach that's going to be offered on Shabbat. The B'nai B'Teira, the local sages, don't know the answer. And Hillel comes from Babylonia to give the answer. What does that mean? How do they not know the answer? What does that mean? And I compare it to communist Russia. You have a generation of teachers that have to go underground and that cannot continue to teach. And Hillel, and the Gemara says this, Hillel comes from Babylonia and reestablishes the Torah. So that is a very, very much an anti-Herod, right? That is a very significant one. We also have a very strong cultural influence of the Romans, which is not necessarily a good thing. Okay? Now, If you know anything about Israel, you will know that there are streets in Jerusalem, in Tel Aviv, in Haifa that are named after the most obscure personalities. I once made a bad mistake when I was on Masada, and I said, "We have two streets, more than two, named after the inventor of Esperanto, and nothing named after Herod." And of course, in my group, I had somebody who was a very pro, strong speaker of Esperanto, and he was very distressed. But still, Herod is a big guy. There are no Herod streets in Jerusalem. Nothing is named after him. So you can argue you have all these places that he's created. We talk about him all the time, but there's no Herod Street. And there's a reason for that. Okay. He is seen as accommodationist. He's accommodating to foreign powers. And we are a nation that dwells alone. Am levadad yishkon. And this is why I brought you the cover of this book. This is a historian named Avraham Shalit. And he followed the main line, which is that Herod is somebody who should be shunned, and we don't want to be like him. And these are the early days of the state, and we can go it alone, and we don't need anybody, and shmum, right? And we are independent. And at a certain point in the 60s, he changes his mind. And he says, Herod wasn't so bad after all. And he did a lot of good things. And he writes this book, Herod the King, The Man and His Works, Ha'ish v'Pohalo. And he is ostracized by the entire historical establishment. People call him a fascist. They won't have anything to do with him. And I'll just give you one more example. It was only about 10 years ago that the Israel Museum mounted an exhibit about Herod. That's crazy, okay? Who has had more impact on the geography of this land than Herod? And yet it took until the 2000s for there to be an exhibit about him. Historiography is a reflection of current reality, is a reflection of our ideas and our beliefs. And as we have become more accepting of globalization and cosmopolitanism, et cetera, we've become more accepting of Herod. And there are still schools who are very unaccepting of Herod because of that exact reason. So I am going to stop sharing. I am going to take a look at questions in the chat, and anybody else can ask questions also, but let's just look back here. All right. Did they update the Holy Land Hotel model with new discoveries? No, they have not updated it, and I think that's a policy thing. They don't want to. They want to keep it the way it is. Although there's a whole book about it, and you can find out what is correct and what is not. But they did not update it. I lived in Bait Vagan. I attended seminary opposite the structure. Yes, a lot of people remember that Holy Land. It was, and I have to say, as horrible as the Holy Land buildings are today, the model looks way better in the Israel Museum than it looked in the hotel. Where is this in relation to David Leah? I don't know. This was a while ago, so you have to tell me what is this. But meanwhile, I'm going to go on while you tell me. Batya says Holy Land Hotel, one of the first swimming pools in Jerusalem. Hey, a lot of people remember the Holy Land Hotel. Look at that. All right. Are there any remnants of Herod's palace in the Old City? Yes, if you go to the Tower of David, but very little, really, like the foundations and this pool that's been uncovered. Now they're doing more excavations in the Kishla. Who knows? Maybe we'll find more. How do we know that Robinson's Arch looks as it does in the photo? We don't know 100%. But basically, we can figure out the trajectory of the arch. We can see where it leaned on. And also, we base ourselves on other things from the same time period. But yes, obviously, there's some conjecture. Did they use separate dishes for meat and milk? The Gemara, as far as I know, Rabbi Kelman is welcome to correct me and to add to this. As far as I know, we do not hear so much about that. They definitely did not cook meat and milk together or eat meat and milk together. But we don't seem to find dishes in archaeology that seem to be meat dishes, milk dishes. That's a good question. I do not know about it, that this has been found. Okay. Where is the burial tomb displayed and what happened to the body inside? I assume you're talking about Herodian. Body's long gone, right? The whole thing was knocked down, was destroyed, no more bodies. The tomb, you can see in Herodian what's left of it. There's a model that's meant to show as a reconstruction, but you can see the remains of the actual tomb in Herodian. Was archaeological work done on Solomon's pools in the 70s and 80s? I do not know, honestly. I do not know. It's very possible, but I do not know. Did anyone pay attention to the curse on rebuilding Jericho? Okay, that's already a Tanakh question. But in the time of King Ahab, in the time of Elijah the prophet, hey, we have this guy named Chiel Beit Ha'eli who defies Yoshua's curse. He rebuilds Jericho. He pays for it with his sons' lives. But it seems that after that, once the curse has been defied, there's no problem with rebuilding Jericho. And Jericho is a very important city in Second Temple times. Right? Okay, same question here. In what order did Herod build? How many, if any, simultaneous projects? That's a very interesting question, which I do not have an answer for. Presumably, he was definitely doing a few things at the same time because he just built so much. And Josephus gives us a little bit of an order, but a lot of it is conjecture. You know, some things we can date, like the theater, right? We know he built the theater in Herodium when he was getting a very VIP visitor from Rome. So he built it in honor of him. But we really don't know everything. Were Herod's bones found? No bones. What about his department store in London? Okay, thank you. Also his hotels down in Eilat. Most Christians think that Herod is a typical Jew. All right, that's, yes. Well, Christians also often confuse Herod with his son, Herod Antipas, right? Who, if the story in the New Testament about persecuting Christian babies and Jesus running away is correct, then it's not Herod at all. It's Herod's son. At our age, we do not explain jokes. Okay, I think you answered earlier. The first screen with the street going from the Gihon up is, yes, that's in Ir David, correct. The bone box in Jerusalem. Oh, where can you see that? It's in the Israel Museum, which one day will reopen. There's a book about Herod. I can't remember the title of it, but there is a book about him. But I would really look at the various sites. Right? It depends what you want to know. If you want to know about him, if you want to know about what he built. Again, I will put my email in and anybody who has more specific questions can send them to me and I will try to come up with answers. Who were his laborers, Romans or Jews? Okay, good question. We know the stonemasons are Jews, right? And that's, I think, the more sophisticated and professional work. There definitely are slaves working as well. I don't think too many Romans, but you do have slaves and you do have Jewish laborers. That is the best I can give you for that. Do we have other questions? Exhibit in Caesarea extols Herod's praises. Yeah, it's a weird exhibit altogether. The movie is very strange. But like I said, it depends on your perspective. There are a lot of good things, there are a lot of bad things. Very few people are completely black or completely white, as we all know. Yes, anyone else? No?
Thank you, Shuli, very much. I can still chime in with the question. Dead Sea Scrolls next week, correct?
Dead Sea Scrolls, yes. Get a good nap before, because Dead Sea Scrolls is a heck of a lot of stuff. You need to concentrate a lot. Be prepared. Bring your coffee.
Bring your
coffee. Thank you, everyone.
And bring your friends. And